Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 14th of July, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish, with me in the studio, Mike Robinson. And we will be joined by David Scott with Northern Exposure. I'd just like to say a little bit windswept. The wind has picked up outside there. So if you want to know the weather in Plymouth, it's a little bit of blue sky, but quite a bit of wind.
Okay.
Where was the makeup team, Mike, today?
Well, we sacked them.
We sacked them.
They couldn't fix us. Right. We'll get straight on with Grenfell. The first part of this is obviously, but it continues the public inquiry and the residents' response to the public inquiry. They are requiring or demanding that the public inquiry increases its scope to include the regeneration programme. Brian, I think that I would imagine that this judge is not going to be very keen to go in that direction. But I was just interested in your thoughts on whether that should be something included in this inquiry or not.
Well, I would say it should be, Mike, because the experience of a lot of people here in Plymouth and other cities across the UK has been that where these government-created regeneration programmes have been put in place, we have seen I'm going to use the word deliberately, a transformation in the way that local authorities behave. They become very aggressive. The vision for the transformation is the thing that drives all of the policy. And they have no time for any nasty little local people that get in the way of their plans. So we've had reports and dialogue with members of the community across the country, Sheffield, Newcastle, Glasgow, London. Anywhere these major regeneration programmes have been put in place, there's been a step change in the behaviour of local authorities, and inevitably they've become very domineering, aggressive, and the party politics, the vision for the future, is the primary goal, people's real interests second place.
Mm. So people really keen to understand why residents' concerns have been systematically ignored, as they describe it. Just to reinforce, that's something we've seen right across the country.
We've seen that right across the country. And it doesn't matter what the subject is. The subject could be safety on the streets. It could be the crime rate, whatever it is that local people are genuinely experiencing and concerned about. They are not going to have a proper dialogue with the local authorities because the local authorities have been changed into political fiefdoms.
The Mirror here, headline is Scandal of Flats Standing Empty as Grenfell Tower Families Live in Hotels. And this is 159 social housing flats which have been identified in the Kensington-Chelsea area. The council says we're continuing to make good progress on rehousing during a complicated process involving severely traumatised people. So far, 167 first offers have been made, 25 offers have been accepted, 8 households have been rehoused. So that's 8 households so far have been rehoused. But the point here is that 159 empty flats on the Sutton estate. But of course, these flats are boarded up. They're derelict at the moment. There's no sign of those being refurbished at this stage. The housing association is called Clarion. It was originally called Affinity Sutton. They have offered a number of flats on another part of the estate, but they're saying that the tenants would have to carry out repairs at their own cost.
Yeah.
So residents saying they're shocked and appalled that this is going on.
Well, Mike, this is one of the key areas. And of course, this is a con carried out by the government. But when they started to get rid of council houses, now council houses had a mixed reputation across the country. Some of them were built to quite good standards. Some of them were very poor indeed. But the key thing about a council house is that once people had been on the list and they'd secured the council house, it was theirs for life. It stayed in the family. If there were children, they might end up living with mum and dad. They might end up with grandmum, granddad living with the family. Then what the government did is said, no, we've got to improve these things. We'll give you an updated kitchen or an updated bathroom. There was a bribe element to this. And these updates were then used to bring in the housing associations. And what the housing associations were really was a for-profit system. They say they're not for-profit, but they are in fact a for-profit system. And with the housing associations came the removal of secure accommodation for life. So as the housing associations have come in, who are they accountable to? It's not really clear, because invariably they have members of the local council on their board, but they're private organisations with a public sector input. It's very confusing. But these housing associations have become increasingly dictatorial in telling residents what they can and cannot do if they are to remain living in one of their properties.
So regeneration at the heart of all this. So this headline from Get West London: West London College's merger plan will benefit students and staff, it says. Now, this is interesting because it involves Warmington College, which is part of Kensington Chelsea College. So this is Ealing, Hammersmith and West London College, and Kensington and Chelsea College are going to merge. They say this is a move that's going to benefit everybody. Now, Ealing, Hammersmith and West London College has sites, four sites, and Kensington and Chelsea College has two sites. And as I say, one of those is Warmington College. Now, this article in Get West London makes a statement that under the move, both colleges will retain their existing sites and names. And this is very confusing, Brian, because Kensington and Chelsea, right at the time that people are obviously upset about what's going on with Grenfell, have decided that it's time to knock down Warmington College, the building that's in, and to regenerate it. So what they did, without so much as a buy or leave, without asking anybody for their opinions, in April last year, they bought the building for regeneration. They're going to turn it into flats, apparently. But they say that they're still going to accommodate the college. But this college is something that local people rely on, absolutely. It's something that helps people, anything from learning English as a foreign language to getting people up to a standard to enter degree level courses around the country. So the local community appreciates this, and they're extremely concerned at the moment that this college is going to disappear as a result of this deal. They don't really understand why the deal has happened. And there is a campaign group, if anybody's interested. It's called the Save Warmington College campaign. You'll find it on Facebook. Do go and have a look. But the key point here is, a community which is already suffering the effects of regeneration continues to suffer. And of course, some people might take the view, well, hold on, they're wanting to knock down an old building and replace it with a new building. Why would you complain about that? Well, for the same reason that when they knock down many of these social housing buildings and replace them, they replace them with fewer homes than were there originally.
And they were too expensive for local people to afford.
Exactly. So people are extremely sceptical about whether this is actually going to turn out to be what's promised.
Well, I'll just add to that, Mike, that I believe that what is going on here, this is big society at work, big society which is never mentioned in the mainstream press and media at the moment, is definitely there. It's being built. And, of course, in big society, the state is to control everything. It's to control industry. It's to control housing, education. And, of course, we can see that the NHS is being privatised at the moment. It's very nearly there. And so we've seen the destruction of local amenities across the board, whether they are community centres or homes for the elderly, they go, local libraries are going, local education facilities are going, and what's invariably replacing them is something that's always bigger and shinier. But if you look at what the control is, what it's really based on, it's profit.
Interesting you mentioned the library, because Kensington and Chelsea has decided to close the library in the area and install a private school into that building.
So libraries being decimated across the country. Many people say this is because, of course, if we end up with a system of knowledge based on the internet and in electronic form, that information can be changed overnight.
Well, let's bring David Scott in at this point because, David, welcome to the programme. Grenfell Tower insulation was not certified for use with flammable cladding, according to The Guardian. The mainstream media continuing to flail around on this issue?
Yes, and it's very striking that, the sort of areas we were covering, some of this we covered on the 15th of June, and we've covered in articles since, are now cropping up, you know, belatedly in papers like The Guardian and on the BBC. This article here mentions, it looks at the issue with Celtex insulation, which is the insulation board which generates the toxic gases when heated. It says it wasn't certified for use with combustible cladding. And an interesting comment here, a spokesman for Kensington and Chelsea said, quote, "We know there are many questions relating to fire safety standards," end quote, "but the council declined to comment further until," quote, "until this issue has been discussed with the police and the solicitors to the public inquiry once they have been appointed." So we know there's a big problem with the fire safety standards. Now, we've been writing about this for some time, as you know, and no one else really seems to have been covering this particular aspect of the problem. But Kensington Council know that's a problem, but we're not going to do anything now. We're going to wait until other people are appointed.
And then the BBC saying government to review building regulations, again, a point that you've been making for quite a number of weeks now.
Yes. This is, again, a very interesting article, worth the read. A couple of quick quotes here. They remain unclear as to whether the problem is the rules or the enforcement. Well, if they want to be clear on that, we have two articles in the UK column. If you read those, they'll be much clearer. It's not just the rules and it's not just the enforcement, but it's the whole mindset and ethos behind the entire system. It's a much bigger problem than they are indicating. They say it's not clear when the government review will be officially announced, but it is likely that it will be complicated by the ongoing police investigations and public inquiry. So here, yes, we do have a problem with the fire regulations. Yes, they're not fit for purpose. But no, we're not going to do anything just yet because we're going to have an inquiry first. And this one is particularly nice. But ambiguous drafting, this is the BBC, but ambiguous drafting in the building regulations mean that some developers, cladders and architects have assumed that this rule, which is a non-combustible rule which applies to insulation, applied only to the insulation on the outsides of the building, not to the exterior of the cladding. That would be called the BBC lying. It's nothing to do with ambiguous. It's not the ambiguous drafting. It's the precise drafting of the regulation said exactly that. So the BBC not really being very honest there. They then get a quote from Adrian Buckmaster, director of Tetra Clad, a cladding company. He was much more honest. He says, "The government is now saying that both the insulation layer and the outer layer they believe should be of a non-combustible class. Whereas if I read the documents as they are at the moment, the clauses specifically say that it's just the insulation and the outer layer is a completely different standard." So there you see that cladding company telling the truth about the regulations, BBC not quite able to do that.
And in the meantime, Cressida Dick, the Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, has had to come out and really make excuses for the issue over the death toll and whether the numbers are correct or whether they can, you know, all the difficulties they've been facing and trying to reach a number which is correct. I mean, this just gets ridiculous.
It totally. She says, "Nobody would forgive us for guessing and getting it wrong." Well, who says? Of course people would forgive them if they got the number not quite right and it was done honestly to get the information out. That's just completely spurious. That's just excuse for their lack of openness. And she says another few things which are very strange. "I wish this wasn't happening. I wish it hadn't happened. But if it takes a year to do the job, it takes a year to do the job." I mean, why are we talking about her feelings? Why are we talking about her wish that, that reality wasn't reality? This is a person in charge of the Metropolitan Police.
This is a common purpose person in charge of the Metropolitan Police.
True.
Yeah.
I think that is an important point, David. This lady heavily reframed by common purpose. And is she thinking in the right way? I don't think so. She'll be thinking in a way that protects the establishment. But would it be important just to say for our audience, the key issue over deaths in Grenfell Tower, of course, we should know how many people have died, but the start of the process should have been for there to be work to establish what the occupancy level of the building was. Was it at full capacity? Was it over capacity? Was it at a very low level? The initial starting point would be that in order to determine roughly how many people they were looking for. And of course, this is the issue that has never been discussed. And yet the leader of Kensington Chelsea Borough Council said in one of the early press media recordings, when asked about numbers of people in the building, there were thousands. Now, of course, he didn't mean thousands, but that response, I think, indicated he knew the occupancy level of the building was likely to be extremely high. So we come back on the question, why is this fundamental approach of how many people were likely to have been in the building? Why is the government refusing to talk about this?
Mm. Okay. And the Guardian here says the police have said they expect the number of fatalities to remain around 80, despite residents and survivors claiming many more may have been killed in the 24-storey building. So the Guardian have been forced to report now that the word in the community is that this figure of 80 is not credible. And this whole piece is to defend that position and defend the official line.
Absolutely. Okay, we'll move on. Now, a couple of days ago, we mentioned that the NATO-Russia Council meeting was taking place yesterday. One look at the NATO-Russia Council website, they still have the statement of their position, which they made in 2014 on Russia, which says, we have decided all practical civilian and military cooperation between NATO and Russia to suspend all practical civilian and military cooperation between NATO and Russia. Our political dialogue in the NATO-Russia Council can continue as necessary at ambassadorial level and above to allow us to exchange views, first and foremost on the crisis. We will revise NATO's relations with Russia at our next meeting in June. Well, that was in 2014. And the situation actually hasn't changed since then. But nonetheless, they had a meeting of the NATO-Russia Council, and Jens Stoltenberg said that it was a frank and useful discussion, although particularly on Ukraine and Afghanistan, that Russia and NATO have continued to have fundamental disagreements. He said it's significant that at today's meeting we exchanged advanced briefings on upcoming exercises, and I'm encouraged by this progress, but he said that from previous experience, we have every reason to believe it may be substantially more troops participating on the Russian side than officially reported numbers. So anything to get a dig in. Well, what did the Russians have to say on their side? Well, Alexander Grushko, the Russian ambassador to NATO, said the main topic of today's meeting was the military political situation in Europe. He said that against the backdrop of the media hype around the Russian-Belarusian exercises Zapad 2017, the plans of the NATO countries to hold over 15 drills in Eastern Europe at approximately the same number in the Black Sea region remain unnoticed. So complaining about the press coverage of the reality of the difference between Russian and NATO exercises, he said to achieve real progress towards de-escalation or at least to gain some degree of mutual trust between Russia and NATO, it's necessary to think about restoring systemic military contacts. Well, this is exactly the point that the Russian NATO-Russian Council is saying are suspended. They remain suspended, and there's no sign of that changing. And he said, we have a common understanding that we will not allow Afghanistan to turn into a safe haven for terrorist organizations, including ISIL, as well as the flow of terrorist threats beyond the country. Long-term stabilization and peace can only be achieved through political and diplomatic means. And he also said that NATO's support to Ukraine actually encourages Kiev to go ahead with the war in Donbass. Russia's permanent representative, that's what he said to the council meeting. So really not much positive coming out of that, really, on balance, Brian.
the pot is being stirred so that it becomes ever more opaque as to what's really going on behind the scenes.
Well, the pot is being stirred, and one of the other things that's going on behind the scenes is a spat between the US and Russia over property in the United States, because Obama decided to remove the Russians from this property. Maria Zakharova, in her foreign ministry briefing yesterday, said if the US partners do not understand differently, and what she meant by that was that Russia is now ready to expel US diplomats in response to the US failure to return its diplomatic property in New York and in Maryland. So she said if US partners don't understand differently, we will at some point have to act in this direction to expel people, and that she's concerned that this is going to drag on. So, you know, this kind of stuff continuing. And in the meantime, well, this is, from NATO's point of view, a really pretty big piece of news, because Turkey, a NATO member, apparently has chosen to buy missiles from Russia rather than from a NATO partner. Brian, this has got to be treason from NATO's point of view.
Well, I find this fascinating because, of course, for Russia to supply those missiles, they must come with some pretty strong caveats, because I would imagine the last things the Russians would want is a missile to be calmly handed over to the Americans. So can Turkey actually sustain working with both sides, or trying to play both sides off against each other? Or is the fact of the matter that really Turkey realises that their bread is buttered with the Russians?
That seems to be the case. Just to put this in perspective, this is a $2.5 billion contract for four Russian S-400 surface-to-air missile systems. So it's not insignificant.
Yeah.
Michael Fallon yesterday was at the Air Power Conference, 12th, 13th of July, and he was making a number of announcements. He said that we've managed to squeeze the world into one room at this conference, apparently with 45 air forces from five continents there. He said that the role of the United States Air Force and Marine Corps have played in training up RF-35 pilots was, you know, really important. They trained up our F-35 pilots and ground crews. I'm not sure that there's any difference, because I'm not sure that the F-35 will ever fly, but that's another matter.
Well, rumour has that it has taken to the air a couple of times, Mike, to be fair.
Yeah, but it keeps trying to kill its pilots, so it gets pretty difficult. He said that we have around 125 pilots and ground crew being trained on our 10 F-35s, and there are others in the United States. And he said that we've been using our rising defence budget to spend $178 billion on upgrading our kit and future air fleet, that our future air fleet is now emerging. And he said we've been using our... he's just said that twice for some reason in the press release. But anyway, the point is they're spending lots of money at the moment. And the question is, Brian, is this with a view to getting it ready for handing it over to the French?
I would say so, because we know that behind the scenes, nothing has stopped in the race to get this EU military unification in place, and the government's not talking about it, MPs are not talking about it. Our own Plymouth MP, Johnny Mercer, of course, who's part of the Defence Committee, doesn't want to talk about it. Gary Streeter, local Tory MP, doesn't want to talk about it. EU military unification is being put in place very quickly, and the government's simply not talking about it. But I'll just add to that, fascinating that we're having these global air power conferences now. So you can see that whatever you think, there's a drive to get rid of the nation states and to bring in global military control.
Now, just briefly, because I want to get David in, because he has to leave early today, but the other thing that Fallon announced was that women would be allowed to take up every role in the RAF, including frontline roles. Yep. Any thoughts on that?
Well, it's a hot topic, this one, Mike, because on one hand, if you go in the wrong direction, then ladies get upset because they say, well, actually, this is a barrier on equal rights for women. But what I see is that this is nothing to do with equal rights for women. What this is to do with is to actually help destroy traditional family values. how can I justify that statement? Because we can say that if women were to get jobs on parity with men in the military, they would do the same jobs in the same circumstances under the same conditions, i.e. you would have combat units of women put in the field on their own. But the military doesn't do that, because the hard fact is that where they've tried this, the women are being outclassed. Now, this is not a sexist remark. This is to do with the reality of whether you're going to put men in the field to do the fighting job, or you're going to put women in the field. So the harsh reality is that with the army, at least, if you're going to put the girls out there, they've always got to be part of mixed units. And this is the fact the government won't talk about. But ultimately, this is a stepping stone to bring in the full gender equality, where we're not even going to be sure whether somebody is a man or a woman brought into the military. So this is a highly political agenda. It's nothing to do with women's rights or the benefit of women. If women want to become soldiers and get out there and die fighting, the government's very happy to take them. But the underlying part of it is a political agenda. David, I don't know whether you give me a little bit of support on this one. We knew at some stage we're going to have to get into this topic. Of course, the Russians used women in the front line during the Second World War. Those women, of course, did a fantastic job. Is it something we should be proud of, that we've taken, I'm going to use the phrase deliberately, mothers, and trained them to kill? I think there's some interesting questions.
There are indeed. There's the question of effectiveness. If you're talking about something like a fighter pilot, it's how many G you can pull, and I understand that it's extremely physically demanding. I wonder whether, in fact, the female airframe would actually be up to that and would be able to operate at that sort of level, or you'd be putting people into a situation where they're at a potentially deadly disadvantage because of the physiology. And then you have the wider aspect that we've always taken a point of view in our culture that it is the man's job to look after such things as national defence, and to make that sacrifice. And that's been part of the exchange between the sexes that has been broken down since the 1960s. But nothing's really been put in its place, and no one's really looked at the reality of what it means. And we're seeing a great many unhappy women in this society, and we're seeing the position of women and the role of women and the respect for women decline quite markedly. And this has all been sold by feminism. I think there's much to talk about there, and I'd be delighted to do so when we've got a bit more time.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Well, let's move on to what's happening within UK. And this is a very interesting headline from The Times. Will block Brexit laws, warn Scottish and Welsh leaders. So the whole thrust of this article is that Nicola Sturgeon and her Welsh counterpart are now saying, well, we're going to do everything we can to block Brexit because we don't think it's in the best interests of the Welsh and Scots nation. So this is one of the key comments that came out from Nicola Sturgeon. The government's plans published in the so-called Great Repeal Bill is a naked power grab by Westminster that undermines the principles of devolution. Now, I found this fascinating because, of course, if we go back to where devolution came from and the push for devolution, it just happened to come at the same point that the European Union was pushing for a European Union made up of regional states and not nation states. So my personal opinion is that the programme was to divide and rule the United Kingdom by breaking it up into the smallest component parts. And what better way of doing it than to stoke up animosity between the Scots and the Welsh and the English as England was broken up into the EU regions. But of course, all that has now been forgotten. And the EU still doing well at the moment that it can use Wales and Scotland to play off the power base in in Westminster. But having said that, it was the UK column that consistently warned what was coming here was a Conservative coup. And it's undoubtedly true that Westminster is now pulling the strings over everybody by playing one off against the other as Westminster follows the European Union policy. And David, I know you're short for time, but if you can just give us a couple of words on this, because it seems to me that however we look at it, Westminster, a totally pro-European Westminster as it is working on every single tactic it can to divide and rule people within the British Isles.
This is the issue. We have a parliament that is not representative of the will of the people, does not really believe in Brexit, but is being forced to move in that direction by the British people. And some are resisting this in secretive ways. And we don't have a majority in Parliament that really has an idea as to what the vision for this country is outside of the EU. And they're being reluctantly dragged along. And they're doing everything they can to derail the process. And of course, when you get to Nicola Sturgeon and indeed the Welsh leader as well, we have here a terrible problem of hypocrisy, because Nicola Sturgeon has told us that it was ridiculous to say that all this power rested with the EU, that the EU was no threat to our national sovereignty, and we should vote to remain in it because it was benign as an organisation. And now when the powers are being about to be divvied up, the mere threat of them going to Westminster is a naked power grab. Well, that rather suggests that there was naked power to be grabbed, something which she had formally denied. And then we have the other basic underlying driver behind nationalism, as it claims to be in Scotland, which is the democratic deficit. You know, oh, woe is us because the nasty English keep voting Tory and we don't, and this is terrible. And we need to redraw the lines in the map because that will solve the problem with democracy, when of course it won't. But it doesn't seem to be any consideration for the situation that the Welsh and the Scots derailing, being minority within the country overall, derailing the entire will of the country as a whole, represents a vast democratic deficit. And if they were consistent, they wouldn't do this. But of course, they're not consistent. There's no consistency. There's no soundness. It's just opportunism.
Okay, well, I'll just bring this quote on screen, a biblical quote, but it's the key one, I think. And if a kingdom be divided against itself, that kingdom cannot stand. And if a house be divided against itself, that house cannot stand. And we can look at that quote in context of the nation, of the nations of the United Kingdom, and the House of Westminster, if you like. But down in the corner, you may have missed it, it said Europe's hidden hand. And I just wanted to bring people's attention to the European Union. This is a very interesting little flow chart which attempts to set out how the structure works. It provides a useful overview, but I just wanted to remind people that, of course, in the middle of it, we have the money empire. And interestingly, this diagram shows the flow of information, control, directives, power in the European Union. But the European Central Bank just sits there, apparently isolated.
Doesn't seem to be doing anything.
Doesn't seem to do anything at all. Whereas I'm going to say the exact opposite applies, that money is key. And of course, what the European Union used to help break up power structures inside the United Kingdom was the lure of EU grants. And it was those millions that the EU constantly dangled in front of local authorities, for example, that got local authorities paying attention to European policy and not our own policy of central government. But the hidden hand aspect, if you'd like to get some idea of what we're really talking about here, I found this very interesting document flagged up on NGO Monitor, Europe's Hidden Hand, EU funding for political non-government organisations in the Arab-Israeli conflict. Now, although it's chosen the Arab-Israeli conflict here, what this article is actually pointing out is that political money was being used to drive policies which were not only against human rights, but they weren't even part of the policy of the European Union in the first place. You can look this up on the internet yourselves, but here's the executive summary. If we just expand a couple of these paragraphs, it says here, in addition to offering services, their reports, this is EU-funded NGOs, their reports are perceived as providing expert information to policymakers, journalists and others, and their campaigns have, quote, significant political impact. These activities are, however, often inconsistent with the stated objectives of both the NGOs and EU frameworks on which they're funded, including the use of funds ostensibly designated to promote peace for pursuing political objectives which, quote, undermine the protection of human rights. So this is describing money which is being used for purposes which are not even in line with the EU's own policies. This is black money. This is black politics. This is hidden from public sight. And if I bring up this other paragraph here, and it comes, in addition, the official guidelines by which the NGOs are selected to receive public funds are very vague, allowing a high degree of individual preference and bias on the part of EU officials. These often anonymous officials and outside experts decide on the allocation of millions of euros to highly political NGOs, yet are not subject to any external process of accountability. The absence of specific performance indicators to evaluate the impact of EU-funded NGO projects adds to the accountability deficit. And although this particular document, as I say, is focusing on the Arab-Israeli conflict, this is exactly the same technique that's been used by the European Union inside the UK and other European countries to divide and rule. And we'll bring this one on just to bring a smile to David's face. But basically, The National reported that a lot of money flowed in from Berlin in order to influence the Scottish referendum vote. And the cartoon on the right is a UK column creation, of course, with Nippy Sturgeon apparently having a love affair with her flick. But David, there's no question that the EU has used its billions of euros in order to buy and influence internal party politics.
And using the NGOs is the NGOs and think tanks. It works on the ground. We've seen this in Scotland. We've seen all of the policies currently followed by the SNP administration, and many of them followed by previous administrations, came from think tanks, NGOs, and various, quote, independent research bodies, which were surprisingly well funded. And they wrote papers, and those papers became the basis of legislation. So it's not really your politicians, and it's certainly not the people who are making the laws.
Indeed. Well, what sort of people are making the laws? Let's bring in Stephen Kinnock, because, of course, he's now stepped forward to say that he's working with at least 15 Conservative MPs in order to get them to take the right action to, quote, defeat Theresa May's hard stance on Brexit. Now, this man's of great interest to me. Of course, his power base is South Wales, where his parents, Neil and Glynis Kinnock, were MPs. This is one of the things he said. There's a growing recognition of the need for Britain to embrace a Norway-style arrangement to head off the threat of severe economic damage. I haven't seen any evidence of this severe economic damage, Mike, so I'm not sure what he's talking about. But of course, the sheer hypocrisy is that, of course, this man was involved in the debacle over Tata Steel in South Wales, which we'll see in a minute. He says here, there's a growing recognition now in the economy that getting the right transitional deal is now the top priority. What we need to do is form a coalition of common sense to secure in particular a sensible, pragmatic transition deal, which in my opinion should be based on the European Economic Area. So they're now trying to blur it by saying, well, we don't really need to leave the EU. We can just simply go back to where we were in the 70s. But you'll notice that I've put common sense in the common purpose colours, because, of course, remember that as Tata Steel started to collapse, we had common purpose, the organisation, working to help Tata expand its operation in India as opposed to expand its operation in South Wales. And these were some of the comments by the Tata bosses. He wanted to bring some unity and common purpose to the to this sprawling conglomerate. So common purpose as an organisation, a charity, helping a foreign steel producer to expand overseas, not in UK. And it was Stephen Kinnock who went begging to Tata, apparently on behalf of his constituents. But the surprising thing is that it was Glynis Kinnock, Stephen Kinnock's mother, that Julia Middleton went running to when common purpose started to be exposed by the UK column. So I'm going to say there's a very dirty circle here where we have a supposed charity getting involved in the creation of steel jobs. On one hand, Labour has been working with Common Purpose. On the other hand, they're apparently not working. But this was the letter, if anybody is interested. So basically, Glynis Kinnock and Enid Morgan MEP from the Labour European office had responded back to Julia Middleton. She had been complaining that their organisation was being exposed by that nasty man, Brian Gerrish, and a particularly nasty man, David Noakes, apparently, together with UKIP and the British National Party. It was all terrible that freedom of information requests were being put in to ask what Common Purpose was up to. And here's the correspondence between Glynis Kinnock and Julia Middleton. So I better just add to that, I have not forgotten that in one of Jeremy Corbyn's first public speeches, he was busy talking about what our common purpose should be. I don't think this was by accident at all, because common purpose was working from the office of the Deputy Prime Minister. That was Labour MP John Prescott since 2001. And I think that organisation is still there, still at its devious work.
Right, we're nearly out of time, but we'll just do a little bit of quick editing here. David, how much time have you got?
About 3 or 4 minutes.
3 minutes. Okay, well, we'll just cover this issue if we move to Israel then. Tell us what your thoughts are on these two police officers who I believe actually died in this at the end, did they?
Yes, the police officer's killed here and the perpetrator's killed as well. This was on Temple Mount. Now, the reason I'm flagging this up is this is the single most volatile piece of real estate on the face of planet Earth. This is the third most holy site in Islam. This is the location of the former Solomon's Temple and the second temple as well in Jerusalem, and is holy to Judaism. Now, this is a powder keg of such proportions it's difficult to imagine, and it's going to be play a central part in any major conflagrations that erupt and that might involve the whole of the Middle East and perhaps Europe as well. And when you start seeing bullets flying around on Temple Mount, and the attackers smuggled in handguns and rifles, shot two policemen, got onto Temple Mount, were heading towards the mosque where they were presumably going to barricade themselves in and take shelter or continue sort of violent resistance. When they were shot, and there will be some questions asked, I think, what happened after they were shot, because one or two of the reports rather suggests that some of the shooting was perhaps unnecessary, so that will come out as well. But when you see bullets flying around on that particular piece of real estate, we should all pay very, very careful attention, because that has the ability to cause World War III. It is that sensitive.
Okay, and you wanted to also mention this from Heretz as well. But, sir, it's an American ship talking about the USS Liberty a couple of days ago.
Yes, Heretz, a good paper. I mean, this is very much soft-playing the incident from an Israeli point of view. But this was the USS Liberty, which was attacked in 1967 by Israeli fighter planes and torpedo boats. And the report, there's a 302-page book called Remember the Liberty, Almost Sunk by Treason on the High Seas. And the book includes, amongst other things, a CIA document from 1967, still partly censored, which is also on the official CIA website. An anonymous source is quoted as saying, they said that the then Israeli Defense Minister, Moshe Dayan, personally ordered the attack on the ship, and that one of the generals adamantly opposed the action and said, this is pure murder. There's no dispute about the authenticity of that document, nor of the exchange between the Israeli pilot and the IDF war room. The pilot said, this is an American ship. Do you still want us to attack? The IDF war room said, yes, follow orders. The Israeli pilot said to the war room, but sir, it's an American ship. I can see the flag. IDF war room to the pilot, never mind, hit it. So the suggestion, Haaretz, is that it's all a conspiracy theory and that really it was fog of war and a mistake. But that story is not going to go away.
No, indeed. David, thank you very much for taking us through that. And I will just add that UK Column will continue to report on matters in the Middle East and matters connected with Israel. We understand there are some people who are very sensitive to this topic, but we feel it's important that where the truth is, where the facts are, we're going to continue to report. And I'll end on a happy note. Thank you very much to the people who've donated to us over the last few weeks. I'd like to say a special thanks to Mac and all the other people who've made us donations. And I'll add, though, of course, if you're not a subscriber to UK Column, please will you consider taking out a subscription. We know there are many people who enjoy watching us, but they do so for free. We can only do what we do with your financial help and support. So thank you to those who've donated. Come on, take out a subscription if you're not already subscribing. Thanks for joining us today. We'll be back at the same time on Monday, and hopefully those makeup girls will be in, Mike.
Don't know what they can do.
Okay, thanks very much. Bye-bye.